From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we continue our ongoing conversation with the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, Joe Loria, with a review of the top stories at the website, consortiumnews.com. Well, Joe, while all of the rest of the media today, is, so far this week, has been consumed with the funeral arrangements for George H.W. Bush, consortiumnews.com has been taking a look at some of the actual history of Bush 41, as they call him now, and his son even called him 41. I guess that's just the way they name presidents now, is by number.
Giving you a number and taking away your name.
That's right. That's right. Hey, wow. Secret agent man.
That's right.
Well, let's go through some of the stories that you guys pulled out of your own history, really. Robert Parry and analyzing George H.W. Bush more or less contemporaneously as he, you know, his policies were unleashed upon the world. So start first, with the death squads, right?
Yeah, first I want to say I have not looked at 1 minute of any of the coverage of Bush because I didn't need to. I know exactly what it is.
Yeah, we lived there. We saw that live.
We know what it is. And as I pointed out on Facebook, there's something useful about the deaths of American presidents, and that is it exposes the myth-making function that the corporate media has. They're doing it all the time, but often it's subtle, and we don't really know how they're doing it. But when it comes to the death of a president, how the corporate media covers this in both television and the press, you see that their job is to create myths about America, about its greatness, about its spreading democracy, et cetera, exceptionalism, et cetera, et cetera. And the reality, of course, as your listeners know, or they wouldn't be listening to you, I hope there are some out there who are learning something new. They know that the reality is far different. And what better way to do that, to counter that, was to bring back out of the archives of Consortium News the many, many articles that Robert Parry wrote about George H.W. Bush, particularly surrounding Iran-Contra and the October surprise.
Yeah.
This is what Bob's great journalist accomplishments were. He brought the name Oliver North to the world when he exposed the Iran-Contra scandal taking place inside the White House, of course, buying weapons from Iran, the great evil country, and through Israel, middlemen, and then selling them to Nicaragua Contras after Congress had cut off funding because of the massacres of civilians that the Contras had undertaken. And that was a complete violation of the Constitution. It's up to the Congress, of course, to allocate money, not the executive branch. So that was one of the worst scandals in American history that gets overlooked somehow. Watergate gets much more billing. And I think what Reagan and Bush did there was perhaps maybe even worse than Watergate because of the totally unconstitutional role, and also because of the people died, really, who died from Watergate. People died because of Iran-Contra in Nicaragua. So, and the piece we have up now, the Bush's death squads that Bob wrote on January 11, 2005, is really interesting because, again, it's about people dying, and it's about the decision during the Reagan-Bush, George H.W. Bush as vice president administration in the 80s, to fund terrorists, really, civilians and leftists in El Salvador. And what Bob does in this piece is to draw a line from that El Salvador option, as it came to be known, to the Iraq War after his son had invaded Iraq. They discussed, at the time he wrote the piece, they were only discussing, but then later implemented what they called the Salvador option, which was to fund terrorists, essentially. And we've seen that happen then in Chechnya. We saw it certainly now in the Syrian war, where the United States and its Gulf allies have funded terrorists to try to get the political outcome that they wanted. We saw this in Libya. It's become U.S. policy, and it pretty much started continuous way from El Salvador to Iraq and now on to Syria. So I thought this piece by Bob was really not only looking back again, one of the evil legacies of George H.W. Bush to counteract the unbelievably puffy coverage in the corporate media, but it also nails down a really important part of U.S. foreign policy that's stretched now over 30 years.
Yep.
I need to I want to give a shout out to Sam Husseini, because about an hour after Bush died, Sam tweeted one of Bob Perry's articles, and that's when I got the idea. I may have gotten it anyway, but I said, "Damn, that's a good idea." So I went back and pulled out these four articles to really lay it out there immediately in this at the same time as the corporate media was doing their thing. We did our thing, and hopefully, we've had some influence on some of our readers to think about Bush in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that that Sam Husseini is spreading around some of Bob Perry's work too. It's hard to ignore people when they're right, you know. this piece, the first piece that we're talking about here, that is titled "How George W. Bush Learned from His Father." It's under the Bush's Death Squads. Original title is "How George W. Bush Learned from His Father." As you said, written January or reported January 11, 2005. This is less than 2 years into the second Bush, second Iraq War. And a look back at it. And at that point, Robert Perry is drawing lines between what George Bush 43, or W, was doing in Iraq with what his father, 41, or HW, had done in Iraq. And before that, as he was running the Operation Iran-Contra as the shadow president slash vice president under Reagan. There's actually, you know, a lineage that goes back with Bush into the CIA back another decade or two, where you have essentially the CIA recruiting the most backward elements in a society and militarizing them. This is what we still see playing out today with ISIS and Al-Qaeda and such in the Middle East. This is what was done in Latin America with Bolton and his predecessors, Negroponte, down there during Iran-Contra. And go back to Guatemala, even in 1950s. This is the U.S. pattern has been to do exactly the same thing.
Well, that's right. They probably did something like that in 54 in Iran, yep, where they took religious extremists as well. And yes, this is a long, unfortunate, long pattern that we see. And it's explained very well in this story, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So, so we have that. That's one piece that is covered there. There were five pieces altogether, looking back at the life of George H.W. Bush.
If I could add, Don, when Bush was CIA director, it was after the Church Commission, the Church Committee reports, which had a huge blow against all the intelligence agencies, because it unveiled huge numbers of crimes that they'd committed since they were established with the National Security Act. In 47, I'm talking about the CIA specifically. The NSA came in 1950, and the FBI had existed before that. So we learned a lot about what these intelligence agents were up to, and there was an outcry, and there were huge reforms. Of course, the FISA court was created because of that commission, and also the intelligence house and Senate intelligence committees were created. So for a while, they cut the staff at the CIA drastically. The CIA was cut at the knees. When Ford became president and Bush was vice president, he created what was called the Safari Club, which was their own private, off-the-books intelligence group to do the kinds of dirty things that would not be known by the new intelligence committees. And because they weren't funded by the by Congress, by the taxpayers, they got private funding to do that. So that's one of Bush's legacies too, as a CIA director.
Right. I mean, the Church Committee convened and pretty much wrapped up their business in 1975. Bush becomes head of the CIA January of 1976.
Yep.
And that whole at the time, we were looking at it like it was a house cleaning, but it turns out to have been that whole whitewashing.
Eventually, yes. Yeah, I mean, there was some hope at the beginning. And I think some of the intelligence committees may have taken seriously at the beginning, the FISA court and all that, but it didn't take long to evade that. And they do it very well today. And they completely manipulate those committees. I'm talking about the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA. In particular, they run the Congress oversight, you know, set it the other way around, the way it's supposed
to be. Right, right. Well, here, we're going to do oversight on your committee. Oh, what's that file with my name on it that you're holding? Who's she? Yeah, you know, it's
okay,
an interesting
next
relationship.
Question.
Yes, exactly. How much funding did you want? So So we've got, you know, we've got a whole bunch of nefarious activity that the CIA has been, you know, caught in the midst of over time. Depending on which continent you want to meander across, looking at the remains of Patrice Lumumba in Africa, how many dead bodies across Southeast Asia, Latin America, et cetera, et cetera. Let's look at some of these other stories now. That kind of shows some of the taking a Bush secret to the grave. This one, for example, this is from.
Bob went back back in. He wrote this in September 27, 2011, so 7 years ago. He was still working. In 2011, he was still working on the October surprise story,
right?
Which is, of course, to lay it out briefly, was that the Reagan campaign, not elected, the candidate campaign and his team had contact with the Iranians and got them to withhold the release of the hostages, the American hostages in Lebanon, because they had influence over Hezbollah. So they were able to, in the American embassy in Iran.
Right.
So they had direct control over it. So they got the Iranians to withhold the release, so that the release, the idea was, would have helped Carter win the election.
Right.
And in fact, they withheld them until the moment, the very moment that Reagan was being inaugurated. I mean, that was as fishy as you can get.
Yep.
I can't believe they had the gall to do that, as if that may raise some questions. But they had such confidence that this would never come out that they were able to do that, to stage manage not only the withholding of Americans being held for several months more, but then released him just as Reagan had his hand on the Bible. I mean, and you talk about chutzpah. So Bob worked hard on this both at Newsweek and then at PBS. And Newsweek, of course, killed his stories on this. And then he went to PBS and did a documentary. And more or less, they think they proved it about 90% that this is what happened. And part of this story was where George H.W. Bush was. Was he involved with negotiating this directly with the Iranians in Paris? The Bush said he never went to Paris. And of course, Bob in this piece is showing that he did by going back and looking at real estate records and where he said he was, et cetera. So it's quite an involved story that seeks to show that Bush was lying, not for the first time, that he was not involved directly in these negotiations in Paris. So it's a great read. It really is.
You know,
and again, undercuts Bush's legacy.
That whole affair, by the way, the whole Iran-Contra thing, but starting with the felonious tampering with U.S. foreign policy in order to manipulate the outcome of an election.
Logan Act.
Logan Act, the colluding with an enemy of the United States of America.
Right. Treason.
Yeah, okay, all of that. In the middle of all of that, the Americans are criticized as being historically amnesiac. Actually, that particular case brought like a new level of amnesia to American politics, because every person that they got hold of that had anything to do with Iran or the Contras or any of the funding mechanisms or the crack that was being imported into the country, all of that stuff that was all tied together, every person that they got on the stand from the administration could not recall.
Yeah, they weren't reading Consortium News.
That's right.
Bob Perry dedicated himself to combating amnesia. And he was writing about this into 2011, something that happened in the 1980s. Yeah. 1980, actually, the election of 1980. So you're absolutely right. This is another function of the corporate media, in addition to creating myths, is to bury history. You remember what Winston Smith's job was at the Times of London in Orwell's 1984. His job was to go back into the archives of the Times of London and change it if the they said there was going to a 5-year plan to create so much wheat and they didn't do it, he'd go back and change what the goal was to meet what actually happened, stuff like that. So he went in to tamper with history in the archives. And this is pretty much what the corporate media does on a daily basis. They bury recent history so they create no context for which Americans can understand what American foreign policy is all about. We just did that in the first segment of our program. We talked about the connection between the El Salvador terrorists and the terrorists in the Middle East that are being used today by the United States. There is a, if you don't talk about the history, you don't explain that, it's hard to understand what's going on today. You need historical context in journalism, and there's none of that in the corporate media. And on purpose, they don't want us to remember. They want us to have amnesia. So these crimes can be committed again and again and again. And Bob Perry dedicated himself by founding Consortium News to continuously go back into the recent history and link it to today as well and show the importance and the need for that context.
Now, then there's another story that Bob Perry had reported. This was 24 years after the fact. Another instance of George H.W. Bush and the CIA and a case of state-sponsored terrorism, the article entitled, actually, George H.W. Bush, the CIA, and the case of state-sponsored terrorism. And this is the car bomb that blew up in 1976, September 21st, 1976, and that killed the ex-foreign minister of Chile, Orlando Letelier, who was the foreign minister under President Salvador Allende. He was murdered in a car bomb that blew up on Mass Ave down in Washington, D.C., and Bush...
Middle of the afternoon, if I believe.
That's correct, yeah.
Yep.
And it was a remote-controlled bomb, and it was an Embassy Row. And George H.W. Bush leaked for public consumption an assessment clearing the Chilean government, in other words, Pinochet, which was run by this guy Contreras. In other words, it ran cover for the people that committed a political assassination right here in the United States.
In the Capitol, in the afternoon, it also killed a young woman who worked at the Institute for Policy Studies, where the Delalier was working at the time in the think tank there. So two people were killed, and Bush knew about it, and he covered it up. And Bob gives the story in great detail. And this you're not going to read about in the New York Times or the Washington Post this week while he's being lionized as one of the great men of history. And this is the things he did. This is facts, you know, but facts don't seem to matter to newspapers when a president dies. All of them, no matter what party. It's because they need to continue this myth of the leaders of our country being stalwart men, great men of statesmen who want democracy, without that, this country, they're in trouble because the society would kind of, I wouldn't say dissolve, but there would be problems if the facts got out constantly about who these guys were. There would be an unbelievable demand for change. They wouldn't be able to go along with another string of presidents, whoever they are, no matter what they said during the campaign, even sincerely. Once they get in power, they've got to continue this foreign policy that is not established, that has been established a long time ago and is not reestablished by a new president. They have to follow this or they're in trouble. So in order to continue that going, they need to show that each president was a great man, even though they ultimately were evil men just for going along with policies they may not even have agreed with. I happen to think Bush did agree with this, given his background and the kind of man he was, the patrician that he was, the disdain for the average people. That's how he lost. People say today, even the corporate media are saying he lost to Clinton and that he didn't get a second term because he didn't know what a scanner was at a supermarket checkout.
Right,
and that was symbolic of his not giving a damn about the average people. And anybody was with a half a brain would know that he didn't care about the average people. But he did that. And that was a big mistake because it proved it. You know, it showed to everybody what people probably should have known already, that he was an extremely privileged individual whose father was a senator and his son became president as well. And he made a fortune. And in the guy, you know, probably worked for the CIA before he became CIA head chief. You got to get these facts out. And this one about the death of Letelier is just so, you know, blatantly corrupt to cover up for a military dictatorship in South America when they assassinated two people, including an American citizen, a woman, a young woman, in the middle of Washington, D.C. on a fall afternoon. And Bush, you know, said, wait, you know. But as Bob points out, the CIA, 12 years later, admitted it. This always happens, of course. Truth then comes out, and it's a footnote in history when it should have been the main story at the time. And the press, if it was doing its job, would be digging this out. But they didn't. And when you did try to do your job, as Bob did, you get your story spiked. So you quit in disgust, as he did, and started Consortium News, where I'm really happy to be running the thing and be able to resurrect his stories as they're burying Bush.
Yeah, I'm glad, too. I mean, because another point, you talk about these things becoming a footnote in history. But as a matter of fact, when they go back to revisit the history, they seem to miss the footnotes. Because nobody's mentioning any of this stuff again. They're talking
because it was two paragraphs on page A39, and the researchers didn't find it. I mean, it's unbelievable.
What about the front page of the New York Times in December of 1991? December 1992. Bush pardons six in Iran affair, averting a Weinberger trial. Prosecutor assails, quote, cover-up, close quote. Bush diary at issue. None of this comes up. And then talk about, at the heart of it, was Bush's protege, Robert Gates. Sound familiar?
Yes.
You know, we see Obama and George Bush Jr. standing around Daddy and the circle of friends. You'll understand why Robert Gates was still a player during the Obama administration and why you have Michelle Obama ready to, love Bush to death, as she put it. If only.
Yes. Well, she succeeded. He's dead. So
work.
You know, that front page story from the Bush pardon six, including Weinberger. Weinberger, I got the whole list here because Ray McGovern wrote a piece off of that.
Yep.
In which he named everybody who was Alan Fears, the CIA's Alan Fears, the then Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams, who then served later in Bush Jr.'s administration, and Robert McFarlane, I guess he was the Chief of Staff at the time. So
Claridge and Claire George.
Yeah, all these guys. I mean, he pardoned them just before he left office, of course. Yep. And Ray goes on to tell the story of how he, of course, Ray McGovern, was the briefer of two presidents, Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and he also briefed Bush as vice president, the CIA briefer, every day going into the Oval Office. Now, Ray kept a good relationship with George Bush, even after he left office, and they would write letters to each other periodically. And in the lead up to the Iraq War, just before the invasion, in January of 2003, Ray McGovern wrote to George Bush saying he was worried about what Bush Sr. used to call the crazies in the basement, meaning the neocons, and that George Bush was seen as some kind of paleoconservative, you know, supposedly didn't like these neocons, but his son had embraced them. So Ray said, "I'm really worried, I'm really concerned that I'm aghast at the cavalier way in which the Richard Perls of the Pentagon are promoting the use of nuclear weapons as an acceptable option against Iraq." And he asked Bush if he would speak privately to his son about these crazies who were advising him on invading Iraq. And George Bush wrote back a handwritten note to Ray McGovern that we reproduce here in the article that Ray saved on January 22, 03, and he says, "Dear Ray, it's only meet and right that you speak out. Thanks for your letter. Please do not worry that crazies have any influence on POTUS 43. Here he is, not calling his son by his name, calling him POTUS 43. I will admit that early reporting indicated that, but it was not true then, not true now, and as it is not true now."
Right.
Now, he's lying, because later in his in a biography of Bush, he admitted that Bush, his son, had what he called iron-assed. I hope you don't have to beep that.
Iron-assed advisors.
Iron-assed advisors. He meant Cheney and Rumsfeld.
Right.
So he, you know, he saw the truth, but he lied to Ray directly, saying, "Don't worry about it. He's getting good advice. They're not taking over."
Right.
And the rest is unfortunately a horrible, murderous history in Iraq.
Yeah. I mean, Ray says Junior was a poster child for a crying need in this country for basic instruction on parenting.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And Ray's inimical way.
Yep.
That's right. So, horrible.
All right, so we've got a couple other topics to cover, and we've got about 5 minutes to do it, so let's jump out. What else did you want? You wanted to get?
I want to talk about the Yellow Vest story by Diana Johnston that we published just today.
Yeah, let's do that. Yes.
Well, Diana gives a very long explanation of the economic difficulties facing the French population because of this Rothschild bank-installed neoliberal king, as he's being called. I'm talking about Emmanuel Macron, who you could see right away what this guy was going to do. And he's done it, and he's angered even more the French population. Unlike the American population, the French go out on the streets, at least enough of them to make the news and to make a problem, such a problem that the main demand they had was the revocation of this new tax on petrol, and it was done. They won, basically, at least on that one. But the whole raft of neoliberal policies that were already beginning to be introduced by previous President Sarkozy, France had resisted that to some extent. You know, Mitterrand, even up to that, they had nationalized banks, and they did not buy what was then called like a British economy or American-British economy. They resisted the Milton Friedman, Reagan, Thatcher introduction of neoliberal politics, which is essentially deprivatization, cutting back social welfare programs, and various things like that that hurt the working people of the country and transfer enormous amounts of wealth from the population to the 1%.
Right.
And in France, they resisted that in the government for a long time, and then Sarkozy brought it in, but it's now been completed under Macron, and this is the response. These people are getting in the streets wearing these yellow vests that I didn't know until I read Diana's piece are by law required for to be in each car. Every driver must right. have one. So if they break down and they have to get into the road at night, they will be reflected right. And they'll be seen. I thought that this was a good opportunity to invest in companies that made these vests, but they had already been made. I didn't know that.
They're out there already. Yeah, yeah.
Because it's spreading to Netherlands and Germany. This is what's interesting. See, when you get a symbolic thing like that, the yellow vest, you need something like that to spread this unrest against the same kind of neoliberal policies across Europe, particularly Greece, of course, was hard hit. This is the bankers in control, scooping up the dough, screwing the workers, and the people have had enough of that. And we hope someday the U.S. could do this, but we're so disorganized here. And we have, again, like in Europe, the right-wing populism is leading the charge. And this is what Diana's story is about. She's saying this is the reality. There is no left. Of course, we need a left populism. It's not developing. But she seems to take the position that let's take this what we have. At least they're rising up against these policies, even if they're right wingers. Of course, at this moment, that's correct. But if they should get power, there would be a lot of policies the right wing populists have, that anti-immigration, etc., that and some of them are climate deniers, change deniers, that would not be good. But at this level on the street, at least somebody's getting out there, even if they're part of the right wing populist movement. But we're not seeing that here in the U.S. Trump has continued neoliberal policies here, but he's got his base duped. They're not protesting anywhere near like any at all like what we see in France today.
You know, this is a lot to carry, and we've got about a minute and a half. But the it's early yet, I think, for a response. I mean, a response based on the material to whatever Trump does with the economy, since. You know, you change the terms of NAFTA, or you walk away from the TPP, or you do the tax cut and try to encourage repatriation of capital and investment in factories, whatever. Then there is, you know, pipeline time from the implementation of the policy, even if it's successful. I mean, that's another question, because it hasn't ripened yet. And there are some real strong contraindications in history. But, you know, from the time that the ink dries on the legislation to the time that the first jobs are created to the time that the first paychecks are issued under those jobs and maybe the 10th paycheck, you have a period of a couple of years. And so you haven't really had that kind of a period for an assessment on the ground of whether or not Trump has succeeded in keeping his promises to those people. However, you do have the fundamental unrest among the population. It even predates Trump. In fact, Trump is one of several manifestations of that. So was Sanders. In essence, a loss of legitimacy of the institutions that are supposed to, you know, remedy those problems that people have been facing now for decades. That's something that is shared across the U.S., Europe, and good parts of Asia. And I think that's something we're going to have to keep our eye on. And maybe we can pick up there next week, because we are out of time.
Okay, Don, thank you very much.
Thank you for all the work you're doing. You're doing a hell of a job over there at ConsortiumNews.com.
I appreciate it. It's good, nice to hear that, believe me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.